This is a talk about my own work. So the best thing to do when talking about free surface water waves is to draw draw your domain, that is where the water is going to occupy. So that's what I've done here. I drew a domain in which there is a free surface. I'll just draw it again. Here is a free surface. And I called this sigma, free surface. And then over here, I think of air or vacuum. And then here is water. This is supposed to be the sea. And then there may be a bottom here. And the bottom could be flat, or it need not be flat. But it's especially in today's talk, the work is going to be local in character. And so, in particular, it needn't be flat at all, because I'm only talking about in the neighborhood of the free surface. And then I have to say what happens in that fluid. So I want to describe how the ocean moves, well, how the water in the ocean moves, by a vector field. I'm giving it an Eulerian coordinates, x and to tell you the truth, I'm also going to be in a situation where it's a steady flow. So x is not going to depend on t. It will only depend on x. So I realize I have to give coordinates. So what are the coordinates of space? I want this to be x. And if it's an n-dimensional problem, I'm going to make x an n-1 dimensional position vector. I'm going to make y the other vertical coordinate. Well, it shouldn't matter at all. In fact, it doesn't matter at all, except I want gravity to pull down in y. And then I want u to be a function of x and y. And that describes my fluid velocity field at every point. And my excuse for doing this, well, one, it's a local result I'm going to describe in any case. And secondly, it's for pre-Columbian reasons. So we're going to assume the world is infinite and flat, and we haven't discovered America yet, and we're studying the sea. So it's an infinite flat sea with an infinite flat bottom, and we're looking at the evolution of the free surface. That's the problem that we'll study today. Now, what does u satisfy? Well, I'm going to assume my velocity is incompressible, which, to tell you the truth, was a very reasonable assumption, and I did that for all systems I talked about in my talk on, I'm losing my memory of this earlier this week, on Monday. But I'm going to do something a little bit more artificial in this talk. I'm going to say also it's irrotational. I almost said irrational. It's irrotational, which means I guess I'm also going to assume there's no viscosity. So what it means is that you started with a state which had no rotation in the fluid to begin with, and then among smooth solutions that advects. So it may be, some people call it an artificial situation, but it's one which is often picked up by oceanographers. And now, being irrotational, this is viewed as a compatibility condition for the vector field u itself to be the gradient of a potential. And then once I have a potential, which is a scalar function, once I have a potential, this is the condition that the potential is harmonic. So I'm really studying in the fluid domain Laplace's equation. So that's, say, equation 1. And that's 1 on the board. Okay, now what about boundary conditions? I'm going to assume that I'm in a frame of reference in which the free surface is actually steady. So that can come about in a physical situation from a variety of circumstances. One is that somebody makes a huge splash in the water, the waves move away in a very transient way, but later on stabilize to a nonlinear, steady wave moving at constant velocity somewhere down a canal, something about a canal, somewhere down a canal. And then you gallop along the canal at the same speed as that wave and examine it, take photos or whatever. That, in that frame of reference, is steady. Another situation might be that the mountain stream and a very, very, very even and also infinite mountain comes down, encounters a rock, or maybe does not even encounter a rock, so it has velocity. See, the ocean was at rest at infinity. But now here, there's motion at infinity, and you are the hiker who's taking a rest, so you're stationary, but nonetheless, there can be a nonlinear, steady motion of that stream. From, and the one differs from the other only a little bit, mostly in choice of frame of reference. So that allows me to say this is time independent, and so phi is time independent, and that allows me to go to here. What do I want on all boundaries? Well, the boundary is fixed on top. The boundary, if there is a bottom, is fixed on the bottom, and the fluid is not flowing through it on top because that's what defines the boundary. And so the fluid flow is tangential, meaning the normal component of u is zero, so Neumann conditions, and that's called the kinematic condition in fluid dynamics. Finally, some physics. Not on the bottom, which is a fixed bottom, but on the free surface, we have to satisfy a second boundary condition. So there's boundary condition 1, which is already labeled 2, because this is 1, 1. This is 1, 2. And now 1, 3 is a physical condition. And that is stated as follows. It's a balance law between the height. As you increase the height, you increase your gravitational potential energy, and the velocity squared. And that's called the Bernoulli condition. And I wanted to describe that for you for a second. If we solve Euler flow, d by dt, this is a solution of Euler's equations. So if we solve Euler flow, Boris Kaysen yesterday wrote these equations on the board for us. D by dt is u, the vector field, plus u dot grad u equals minus the gradient of the pressure. And he didn't put other forces in, but there's actually forces due to gravity in the vertical direction. So this is the EY, the unit vector in the EY direction. And if u is given by the gradient of a potential, then this reflects an equation for the potential. And that looks something like d by dt phi plus, well, this turns out to be the gradient of grad phi squared, given the condition of incompressibility. Doing such is one way to eliminate the pressure. Oh, I take that back. You integrate it to find the pressure, and then minus gy is the equation. And if I evaluate this on the free surface, which is a line of constant pressure, I get g eta, and that's exactly, oh, and I, if I evaluate on the free surface, I assume it's steady. If I evaluate on a free surface, this is y is the height, that's eta. If I assume it's steady, this is no term. And if I assume that that free surface is a line of constant pressure, maybe zero pressure, then I get this equation, which is my Bernoulli condition. 3. Yes, please. When there is surface tension, you would substitute that by 3 prime, which was at the bottom of the slide. And now, thank you for being persnickety, because then I get to say 3 prime is in the case there is surface tension. And now the pressure is not zero. The pressure an instant above it, an iota above it, is zero, but then there's pressure below is balanced by the surface tension. And that's equation 3 prime. And sometimes I'm going to talk about...
Without making,
you might have some vorticity. Well, being a mathematician allows you lots of luxuries, including saying, I didn't start it. It started itself at time, and at prehistoric times at minus infinity, is traveling along the flat Earth, and I'm just examining it. Well, we could argue about God, but I don't think it would be worth it. So, in particular, the force applied by surface tension is proportional to, with a constant of proportionality sigma, proportional to the mean curvature of sigma. More comments, persnickety or not. Okay, shall I carry on? Solve Poisson's equation. It's a bigger problem which introduces lots more degrees of freedom. So you could say, let's solve the simple problem first. You drop the ideal stone into the ideal flow and then you look for it. In some sense, this is an artificial problem, and in fact, Feynman used to call this dry water. You stick your finger in it, it doesn't get wet.
The other thing that you're assuming here is you've got an infinitely wide string. No Z.
There's plenty of z-dependence. I just haven't. I've drawn you a two-dimensional picture, but I'm giving you going to give you an n-dimensional result. X is a vector. X is an Rn minus 1. N is not 2. Could be 2. Okay? Question. And this is one question of many one can ask, but this is a classical question that people in differential equations have asked. What is the regularity of the free surface sigma? And so I want to tell you about a beautiful theorem by Hans Blavy, proved before I was born, published in the Proceedings of the AMS. In the case, dimension n is equal to 2. And that is in a channel, or every solution that you have in three dimensions is constant in the transverse dimension. And he says the following thing. Suppose that your solution, so I never really quite put this down. And I also ruined my options for a notation. I was supposed to be a capital phi. And I didn't say that I'm considering, at least when I write down these equations, as this is the height eta of x, y equals eta of x is given as a graph. It needn't be when I move on, but that's what I'm doing to write down the equation at the moment. His theorem says, suppose that you have a solution which includes the potential function and the surface, so they satisfy 1, 2, and 3, not surface tension, but everything else. And suppose that solution is C1 at a point Q in the free surface. So I'll put a point Q here. Here's a point Q, and I'm examining it in a neighborhood of Q. Well, in a neighborhood of Q, intersect the fluid region. Suppose that's C1. Then, a priori, it's real analytic. And maybe it's real analytic. Maybe you prove that estimate in a smaller ball, but nonetheless, it's a local question, point by point. And what's nice is it's sharp, because there's a calculation, a prediction, you might say, due to Stokes, proved much later in the mathematical literature, but still a correct prediction due to Stokes, which is there is a solution which is Lipschitz, but not C1, exactly of these equations. And that goes as follows. There can be a family of solutions is eta could be 0 and phi could be a linear function of x. And that's a perfectly good solution to this equation. But there are perturbations from that which include a solitary wave. And that was studied mathematically by Friedrichs and Heyers and just speculated about by Stokes. And there's a one-parameter family of them rising to what's called the Stokes wave, or the Stokes wave of extremal form that has a Lipschitz singularity. And that nice thing about Stokes' calculation is the angle it makes is not arbitrary or not parameterized. It is 2 pi upon 3 angular opening. Beautiful result. So, question to us is about that first property related to the theorem of Hans Blavy. Do traveling waves, do progressive waves in higher dimensions possess this property of a priori regularity? That is, can I say that solution is C1 or maybe C2 alpha in a space of class of regularity? Can I then say, in fact, it has to be fully regular? Is that, an elliptic regularity property? And the second question I want to say is an opportunity. Oh, sorry, I haven't got the opportunity yet. And I want to say, Hans Blavy did not address the problem with surface tension. So how about problem with surface tension in the picture. They're not here anymore, they're on the transparency. Are solutions with surface tension have that also that a priori, or that property of a priori regularity? So that's the question I want to ask. So I talked to Anna Maria Mattei at McMaster about this, and question one in two dimensions she answered. Sorry, question two in two dimensions she answered really quite right away. So let me tell you about that. It's published in the Compte Rendu in last year. So the dimension is two, and I have these equations in two dimensions, but with surface tension. I realize I should put the equations down because I'm always moving my slides, but I'm always talking about the same equations, essentially. So those are these. I want to solve normal dot grad phi equals 0 on sigma and 1 half grad phi squared plus g eta equals c squared over 2 on sigma. That's equations 3, but with surface tension, I made it into, I don't know, 3 prime, I guess I called it, which is 1 half grad phi squared plus g eta equals c squared over 2, and now I'm having trouble with the sign, minus sigma, the mean curvature of the surface. Someone want to check my signs? Yes. Yes. Well, your intuition is just fine, but it is also a higher order term. So adding sigma times the surface tension with a very small sigma might be like a singular perturbation. So it's not so clear to what extent it dominates. I think your intuition is like Caffarelli's, because I told him about the result, and he says, oh yeah, surface tension is very strong. So you're right. So that's what the theorem says, too. It says, suppose surface tension, the coefficient of surface tension is positive, and then any time you have a solution which is C2, so it satisfies 1, 2, and 3 prime, which is C2, is a priori real analytic. Now, maybe it can go less than C2, but then you need a weak solution definition of curvature. Why not stop at C2 just to be natural? Okay? And it's a special case in R2, which I want to talk about later, but it's a special case of what's now a general theory, well, what was developed in general theory in the 1970s, late 1970s, early 1980s, for a priori regularity of free boundaries. And the papers that I think are most pertinent to the results I'm talking about are a sequence of three papers by Kinderler and Nirenberg, and then later by, and then Joel Spruch joined them in 77, 78, 79. And using those general techniques, they are independent of dimension. So I wanted to say this, make that clear again. Dimension two is special, and I'm going to show why it's special, and that result on top is special. But, yeah. Hooray, life with adversity is nice. Perfect. Thanks very much. Pretty soon I'm going to distribute chalk to the audience. I said I would. Where was I? So in any case, that first result of Anna Maria Mattei was two dimensions, and two dimensions is special, adding surface tension. I'd like to move on to our next result, which is a higher dimensional result, so of a different caliber. And that uses these the techniques developed by Kinderler, Nirenberg, and Spruch. And that goes as follows. When n is greater than or equal to 3, sigma is greater than 0, so there is surface tension, then solutions of equation 1 with surface tension As soon as they are C2-alpha locally, they're a priori real analytic. I want to describe that to you also. So what are the open problems? We'd like to show that when surface tension is equal to zero, that's a singular limit of what this result. We also have that a priori regularity result, but that seems harder, and we have partial results. I'm also going to describe those if I get to it. Another thing is, this is an opportunity. This is where I meant there's an opportunity. That is, I think relatively little is known or even speculated about what are the singularities of the highest wave in three, or higher, but in three dimensions. That is, Stokes made a prediction about what happens in two dimensions. There's a lot more that can happen to a two-dimensional free surface in three dimensions. Why don't we think about that? I think that's an interesting direction to move, and so I'll pose that to you. And so it's an opportunity to us, which, well, at least as far as I know, has not been really taken up. Okay? So let me say this one more time. In two dimensions, complex variables play a very big role, and we'll see that when I describe Anna Maria Mattei's first result, and in some sense, escaping the legacy of complex variables and doing things without those coordinates are what the task is at hand. And then secondly, Nirenberg, Kinderlehrer, Nirenberg, and Spruch series of papers talks about free boundary problems where there's a Dirichlet condition, which is that plays a principal role. Well, in these second order cases, when you have a free boundary problem, typically you have, because it's second order, typically you need to pose two boundary conditions on the boundary. One, because of the potential, the other to specify the boundary, so to speak. At least the count is right. And very often in the past, and from its origin in MHD theory, that's a Dirichlet condition. Well, in fluid dynamics, it's a Neumann condition, and it really changes the character of the problem. I was actually shocked, because I thought all this stuff had been done 30 years ago, and I was shocked to go back and find that, in fact, the Neumann problem is quite wide open. In fact, there are some counterexamples. So one of the first things I'm going to do is tell you about the counterexamples. So let's carry on. I'm going to say a little bit about things in general. So a general form of free boundary problem with Neumann boundary conditions instead of Dirichlet are that I'll look at an elliptic equation. Why don't I just look at Laplace's equation in a domain R? And then on some component of the boundary, I'll ask for Neumann conditions to be satisfied by that potential, and then add an extra boundary condition. And that's g of x and grad phi is equal to 0. If you insist, I can also make g depend on phi, although it's not in our class of problems from physics, but it's possible. Like this. This is a function of grad phi and x and y. And you want that to be satisfied on the free surface. With surface tension, you'll be some general nonlinearity plus some geometric property about the surface. Here, it's sigma times the surface tension equals 0. That's the extra boundary condition. But always Neumann. To compare that with Dirichlet conditions, let's look at, for a stream function C, harmonic, satisfied Dirichlet conditions, and nonlinear function F, which depends on x and the gradient, equals 0. And you can also add the surface tension case. That would also be viable. And that's much more in the purview of the Kinderlehrer, Nirenberg, Spruch sequence of papers. So in any case, what we'll do, in order to avoid having to count too much, both F and G are just going to be real analytic functions. Otherwise, we have to count, and counting is always difficult. When we take derivatives, we'll have to count, and that's always difficult. So let me show you how those two problems are related in two dimensions because of complex variables. So if I satisfy Neumann conditions for phi on a surface sigma, which is a subset of the boundary of R, that's a little bit wrong, it should be subset of the boundary, then that subset is a curve. It's going to be a value on a curve. And if the normal derivative of phi, then the tangential derivative of c should be 0 on that same curve, where C is the harmonic conjugate of phi. So that is, phi plus I psi is analytic. And that says that psi along that curve is a constant. Modulo changing the constant, it might as well be 0. So it satisfies a zero Dirichlet condition. And that the Cauchy-Riemann equations say that there's a relation between the gradients. So if I just do this, f of x and minus j grad phi, and I call that G, then I map one problem to the other problem. So a problem about phi is also a problem about this harmonic conjugate with slightly different f's. And so if you have regularity in some space which respects the harmonic conjugate operator on curves, then I have regularity I can go from Dirichlet to Neumann and back again with no difficulty. In dimension 3, one of the problems is, what should the harmonic conjugate be? And the thing is, there's either too many harmonic conjugates or too few harmonic conjugates. They don't quite do what you want them to do. Maybe that you make them artificially, but they're not doing exactly what you want them to do. So there's no real analog of that very nice thing that's given to you by complex variables. So I want to show you that when you have Neumann conditions, there's a counterexample to a priori higher regularity. So let's do the following thing. Let's set G to be a very nice analytic function of the gradient phi. So G is going to be grad phi squared minus 1. Very nice functional of grad phi. And now I'll take my second most favorite harmonic function, phi. So if I take phi is equal to the x1 coordinate, that's a harmonic function. You should ask me, what's my first most favorite function? Well, I said that this morning, 0. Always check 0. So this is harmonic. Laplacian phi equals 0. Well, now I have a boundary condition, and I also want to satisfy Neumann conditions. So I also have to satisfy, so on some sigma, and also on some sigma, I have to find Neumann conditions of phi equals 0. Just let me tell you what sigma is. So I wanted to do the following thing. And it doesn't work in 2 dimensions, and it only starts working in 3. So here's x1. Then I'll have, how did I do this? I'll have this xn, and have all these x prime. So like x2 up to xn minus 1, all those variables. And I'm going to set a surface, which is a cylinder over x1, which is something like this. So it's going to be this height. Is going to be eta is, so it's xn is a function eta of x2 through xn minus 1. So eta doesn't depend on x1, it makes a cylinder. And now let's just check that the gradient of phi, of course, is always tangent, is always in the x1 direction, so it's always tangent to such a boundary. So I satisfy Neumann conditions. And it's a harmonic function, so I satisfy the differential equation. And not only that, I satisfy G not only on the surface but everywhere, because the gradient length is 1, so 1 minus 1 is 0. And so therefore, this surface is a bona fide free surface for this problem. On the other hand, I can choose my favorite function eta that is C2 beta but not C, no, CK beta but not CL gamma for gamma and L bigger than beta and K. So there's no control. The surface can have essentially arbitrary regularity and still have the problem. Still the problem can run. So that's a counterexample to being able to say, see, some minimal regularity implies full regularity. Okay? So that was when I thought, oh, this is obvious, I'll just look up the classics and see what they did. In fact, this counterexample came to the fore. So now let me tell you about how to prove Theorem 3. How the proof of Theorem 3 goes. Well, I have to remind you what Theorem 3 is. That is, if I have surface tension in the boundary condition in higher dimensions, why does that imply regularity of solutions? So that goes as follows. I'm solving Laplacian phi equals 0 in a domain R, and I want to satisfy Neumann conditions and another nonlinear boundary condition. And what I want to do is it's a local theory. I want to look near a point Q on the surface, and let's suppose that the surface near that point is C2 alpha and phi. That funny squiggle is supposed to be a phi. That's me writing in indelible pens on transparencies. There's also C2 alpha. And what I want to do is make new coordinates. So one of the things about free boundary problems is find coordinates in which the boundary is fixed, and everything else is allowed to move around, and then you don't have any problems with the slipperiness of the free boundary. So constructing an auxiliary function rho satisfying a Laplacian rho is equal to 0 in the region in question, and in fact localize that region just as I did here. I drew a ball around the Q, and I want to look at the hashed off region. Okay? So I want to solve Laplace's equation in that rho equals 0 on the free surface, so where it intersects the free surface, I want that to be 0, and on the inside, that is, on the boundary of the ball, but not near the free surface, I want rho to be given some Dirichlet data, and I want that to be negative. Anything negative, just not 0. Let's make it C infinity negative, just not 0. And then the strong maximum principle says that rho has to be negative throughout the region. And moreover, rho vanishes on this piece of the free boundary, so its normal derivative by the Hopf lemma has to be positive. And I'm going to use rho to make a change of variables. So here's a picture of how that change of variables goes. Here's the free surface, and here's the domain, and I have to solve Laplace's equation here, and I have to find the rho here, which is negative and going up to 0. And now I'm just going to use, instead of xn, which I just changed my coordinates to here, instead of using xn, I'm going to use rho as my yn. So now rho is here. Rho is negative in the region and is 0 on that boundary, so rho is negative here and 0 on the boundary. Rho is my new variable, and the domain is fixed. And of course, what used to be a ball is now some wiggly thing down here, which I sort of drew as a ball. Don't be fooled. And now I have a new equation in that domain. Well, what is that equation? It used to be Laplace's equation. Now it's going to be a little bit crazy, depending on rho, but never mind. So let me talk about that new equation. The transformation yn is equal to rho of x is like a transformation that does the following things. X1 to xn, I'll call it x prime, xn goes to x prime rho. And then I want to say that, can I invert rho for x, the y variables for the x variables? Well, I can do that near Q if I can use the implicit function theorem, that is, if it's non-degenerate at that point Q, which is to say that bxn of rho at Q, which is the normal derivative of rho at Q, is non-zero. In fact, it's positive by the Hopf lemma. So I can invert coordinates at least in a sufficiently small neighborhood. And so I can invert yn is equal to rho of x. I invert that formula for xn as another function, tau of y. Rho tau is sort of next door in the alphabet, so that's the inverse function. And now, if you decide to do that transformation, now you have to transform the PDE. So let's just let's do that. We'll practice doing that. So tau of rho is the identity. Therefore, taking derivatives, the y derivative, the y alpha of tau plus yn of tau dx alpha of rho is equal to 0 by the chain rule, and this is 1 by the chain rule, from which it follows that you could describe x derivative of rho in terms of y derivative of tau, but it's nonlinear. And the same for xn derivatives of rho in terms of yn derivatives of tau. These things appear in the denominator. That's just part of life. And now I want to change variables for phi by saying phi of x is now a new function xi of y, where xi of y is xi of rho of x is phi of x. And then we have expressions for the first derivatives of phi. So x derivatives of phi are expressed in y derivatives of xi. That's a capital xi, right? And y derivatives of phi, xn derivatives of phi are expressed in terms of yn derivatives of phi and also derivatives of rho. And then you also extend these transformations to second derivatives. It's a bunch of algebra using the chain rule. And that's what happens. It gets a little longish, but that's the nature of the subject. So what it comes out is I have to use rho in Laplace's equation for phi. And I get some equation that used to be simply 0 is equal to Laplacian in x of phi, turns out to be a sort of complicated equation, still linear for xi, but nonlinear in tau, for xi. And it depends on tau. So I have a change of variables I defined by rho, or its inverse function tau. And I just changed the linear equation for phi into a new equation for xi, which depends on tau. Okay, good enough. However, I have an equation in x for rho itself. Remember, I'm changing variables by rho. So I now have to change the equation Laplacian rho equals 0 into coordinates for into an equation for tau whose coordinates depend on tau. So it's the same thing I did before, but now my target is not an arbitrary function phi, but rho itself. And you do that, and you get this interesting equation for tau, which is funny and nonlinear, but elliptic. So proposition 4 is, it's elliptic. Proof? This is a proof in the Kinder-Nierenberg-Spruch paper, and their first proof is, well, how can you ruin ellipticity? And then just to show that they weren't so confident as that, they said, proof 2, well, you calculate this and you show ellipticity, and if 2 pages later, it's elliptic. So that reminds me of the physicist proof by reducto ad absurdum. Suppose it's not true. That's absurd. So that was their first proof, which is, you know, just right in this case. So, well, now we've done the equation. How about boundary conditions? Well, rho is equal to 0 on sigma. That turns into the boundary in the new coordinates, so you don't really change it. It's the fact that the boundary is the coordinate plane. Normal derivatives of phi, and then this complicated thing. Well, you transform the normal derivative, and it comes out somehow, and you also transform the mean curvature, and has an expression in tau. I remind you that the mean curvature is not intrinsic. Your changing variable is not intrinsic, so it changes, right? Next slide. I'm not asking you to read all these slides. I'm just showing you that I read them. No. It's locally the graph of a function. Remember, I had the surface, and I put my coordinates right at the point I'm inspecting. And those coordinates were green, looking like that. You want me to show you that? I changed variables for the x's. Just inspect Q and then put your frame so that the normal is xn. It could be upside down, doesn't matter. It's a local question. All right? That's just for convenience. But I do want things which are locally a graph. If it's not locally a graph, then we're in trouble. So make it sufficiently regular. Now I've got my slides all screwed up. I was going to say, now change the normal derivative phi. It comes out an expression for xi and tau. And the nonlinear term g, used to be a function of the gradient of phi, turns out to be some other function k, which depends on y and tau and grad tau and grad xi, and it, you know, has some complete expression there. And you want to solve this secondary boundary condition. You want to solve the normal derivative, which is that, and the secondary boundary condition, which is that. And the theorem is that's coercive. And it depends on sigma being positive. And once you have that theorem corollary, as soon as there's some minimum regularity, then you have full regularity because it's an elliptic, coercive, but nonlinear problem. Coercive, you have to come to the PDE course, but see you in about May. No, it's, it means that it's a well-posed nonlinear elliptic boundary value problem. Coercive basically means that those are the class of problems which have elliptic regularity. You could define it that way. Coercive means the equation enjoys elliptic regularity. But then since both are ill-defined, I've just done nothing. But there are a priori bounds up to the boundary of the solution of all derivatives. And just to verify the corollary, how do you prove the corollary? You look in Mori. First, you look in Agmon Douglas Nierenberg. And also, you look in Mori, because you might as well suffer. And you find if the solution has four derivatives, then it's regular. And then you fool around a bit and get it down to 2 plus any alpha. So you do the usual thing. And I want to prove theorem 5 for you, though. So let's map Q to the origin. Why not? And then And then also asked that our coordinates were as I showed you, as I showed Mary. And then you linearize to check, well Nierenberg, Kinderler and Nierenberg checked ellipticity for us, so we don't have to do that. All we have to do is check coercivity. And you then linearize at that point. It's like freezing coefficients at that point. And if you choose your frame right, the linearized equations, the linearized boundary conditions turn out to be, oh, the linearized equations turned out to be this, and the linearized boundary conditions turned out to be that. And in particular, with sigma non-zero, that's going to be the principal part of your boundary condition, and that turns out to be an elliptic, or so to speak, a coercive boundary condition. So you do a local analysis and find it's okay. And it depends on sigma being non-zero. So question, what happens to the system when sigma is equal to zero? So let's go back and do this a little bit more carefully. The linearized operator at the origin, remember I mapped my point Q to the origin, and then xn is the xn direction at the origin is the image of the normal coordinate. So the linearized operator at y equals zero is expressed in the following matrix. And this is sigma horizontal Laplacian of y, which I set sigma to be equal to zero because I don't want to do the surface tension case, and I basically have this operator. And g is what happens to g at the origin. And in particular, when we're looking at the fluid dynamics case, this is the p derivative of g, which appears here, and this is the pn derivative of g, which appears here, and it's zero. And you take its determinant of its principal part, and it's zero. So that's the problem. Not elliptic. So then you go out and have a beer because it's a little bit tough. Life gets tougher. But there's an alternative to that transformation theory which I gave you where you just solve an auxiliary Dirichlet problem. Oh, actually that auxiliary Dirichlet problem, that was our little contribution. I said there wasn't a good enough harmonic conjugate. That was our substitute for the harmonic conjugate. It didn't do everything, but it did something for us, at least when surface tension was present. We changed variables using it. So you go back and you try another approach, which is I'm always supposed to solve phi as a harmonic function, but now I'm going to solve, again, rho as a harmonic function, but with different boundary conditions. And those are going to be rho equals zero on the boundary, and then grad phi dot grad rho is equal to zero on the boundary, which, if rho is equal to zero on the boundary, that's Neumann conditions for phi, as long as grad rho is non-degenerate. And then g, the old g, is zero on the boundary. And I think this is a promising, I said that this is an open problem, and I think this is a promising thing to consider, a system to consider, but I'm going to exhibit, so I said I haven't finished anything there, but I'm going to exhibit my confidence in this by modifying the problem slightly and showing you that there is a result. Okay? So instead of studying 6, I'm going to study 7, which is harmonic phi, g equals 0 as before, no sigma, sigma 0, and instead of the normal derivative of phi being equal to 0, I'll just say I have a surface, it's a surface as a graph of xn over x prime over the plane of x prime, and all I'm going to ask is the partial by partial xn derivative vanish on the free surface. If the free surface has a maximum, it's the same thing. If it's slightly sloped, it's almost the same thing. And there was a result. But it's not the same problem, but morally speaking, maybe close. So let's examine that problem. And now we do this. So theorem 7 about that modified problem. Well, so it's sometimes said in a derogatory way about mathematicians, if you can't solve the problem, you change the problem. Well, okay, I just changed the problem. But I'm trying to get warmer. It's a warm-up problem. So let's try this. And there's interesting. So, and this is a success. So theorem 7 says that suppose that for a point Q in the boundary, we have two things. One is that phi, that the boundary and phi are C2 alpha near Q, in a neighborhood of Q, and that the xn derivative of G at that point is non-zero. the xn, not the phi n. So it's not like a principal symbol computation, because I'm not looking at the part of g that depends on the gradient. I'm looking at the part of g that depends on xn. I find that a curiosity. But nonetheless, xn derivative of g, non-zero. Then if phi is c2 alpha and non-degenerate, I need to ask the non-degeneracy condition, then in fact it's real analytic in a possibly smaller neighborhood. And the case of water waves is that g is equal to this thing, g dot x. I've changed variables so that nuts is now my new frame, and g is a vector pulling down, so it's not just in the y direction. I'm allowing xn to move. And then the hypothesis holds when gn is not equal to 0, that is, when the free surface is not vertical. Could even be tucked under or over, just as long as it's not vertical. Okay? It's an a priori regularity, so I don't have to say the solution exists. I'm just examining those that do. And now let me prove the theorem for you. Don't change variables according to rho. Change variables, rather, according to a partial Legendre transform with your potential alone. So do the following thing. Old variables x, which are x prime xn, go over new variables y, which are y prime, the horizontal variables, and minus the xn derivative of phi. And that is a transformation which is non-degenerate. Sorry, that's a bona fide transformation in a neighborhood, because the second xn derivative of phi is non-zero, so I can identify a little neighborhood in which the first xn derivative defines coordinates, or coordinate lines. And we recognize that a surface on which the xn derivative of phi vanishes under that transformation is a hyperplane, the xn equals zero hyperplane. So again, we map the problem to a fixed problem with a fixed boundary. Okay? And then I also need to do the Legendre transform on my solution, phi. So I designate c of y as phi minus xn, partial xn phi, which inverts well. And the transformation is well-defined in a neighborhood Q of sigma, possibly smaller neighborhood. And the result is new equations. And you have to figure out what new equations are. Well, this is a Legendre transform. Yn is equal to the minus xn derivative of phi, and its inverse is xn is equal to plus yn derivative of psi, because they're conjugates. One is conjugate to the other. I'm only Legendre transform in the xn, yn variables. Everything else is a parameter. And then derivatives change. The xn derivatives are related to the yn derivatives through derivatives of psi, and the x alpha derivatives and the xn derivatives also through derivatives of psi. And the equations are transformed as well. So Laplacian of phi turns into this funny differential equation for Laplacian for phi turns into a funny differential equation for psi. It's elliptic. Funny nonlinear thing, it's elliptic. The boundary conditions also change. I said the Neumann condition maps to the fact that the image lies on a hyperplane. That's exactly what you want, to straighten the boundary. The auxiliary boundary condition, which depends on g and is nonlinear, does the following thing. It depends on y, through y prime is equal to x prime, and yn has something to do with the gradient of c. X prime depends on the gradient y prime depends on of phi comes from the y prime of I'm saying everything wrong. The y prime of psi depends on the x prime of phi in some way, and then this depends on yn, and that's you want on the surface, on the new surface. And the property, in some sense, the property of what's the principal symbol, so that is what you consider to be a coercive problem, is not invariant, because look, what used to be a variable is now what used to be an independent variable is now a dependent variable, and what used to be a dependent variable is now an independent variable. So when you calculate the principal symbol, the way the functional used to depend on its independent variables, that is, the x's, are jacked up to be the principal symbol. Interesting phenomenon. Okay? Now, if you linearize this at that point in question and study coercivity, ellipticity we have to study coercivity, you find that coercivity depends on whether this is non-zero. And let's check it for the water wave problem. It depends on whether the xn derivative of the gravity dot the x coordinates is equal to zero, and that's gn. And as long as the surface is not vertical, that component is non-zero, it's coercive. Then how low can you go? Flip through Mori, do a couple of days extra calculations, get it down to 2 alpha. That's what I wanted to tell you about today. Any questions? Yes. Well, I'd like to get C2 alpha first before I head for C1 alpha. It would be rather natural to get C1 alpha. Sorry, don't have it yet. That's a very wise question, because sometimes it's the degeneracy of the plane which leads to this lack of coercivity. And I was thinking about that, but it didn't seem to be the case in this problem. Okay, you're right. Map it to a sphere. Nice, smooth boundary. But here you have fixed curvature, and sometimes that helps. In this case, well, I haven't found a case where that works. In this case, I was thinking about that, but it didn't seem to help. I'm perfectly happy to put it there. If you want. And then Alan Newell said, how about the bump? Does the horse have to pull the bump too? And I said, well, yeah, if it's at fluid's at rest and you're in a moving frame, the horse has to pull the bump. So think instead of the rushing mountain stream, and then the rock is there making the wake, and then you canoe over it, you kayak over it, or something. But it's a local question, so it actually doesn't have anything to do with the bottom. It's just what happens right near the surface. This particular question, what happens right near the surface. Yes? With or without surface tension? With surface tension, everything's just okay, and signs are those can exist. Without surface tension, here's what I think, that this is an a priori regularity question for surfaces which already exist and already have minimal regularity. And so I think they don't exist if they're already vertical. They're not steady. They're already collapsing. So I'd say moot. Find me a surface and I'll think about it. No, I think probably everything is locally a graph with gravity pulling in, pulling down. Yes? I think there is. I think there are possibilities for weak solutions, meaning that you could say that you inspect a solution which is C1 alpha, which satisfies these equations which demand 2 derivatives of them in a weak sense, and then carrying on. But I haven't done any analysis in that direction, not yet at least. Well, I'd say its principal application is through inspiration. It turns out, the Dirichlet problem is always trying to play catch-up, and the Neumann problem seems to be always trying to play catch-up on the Dirichlet problem, and that counter-sample says, whoops, you're never going to really be there. Also, you have to divide, you have to decide what you're focusing on. So this particular question is this a priori regularity business. So often Caffarelli's work goes into an existence proof. And often existence proofs, at least traditionally so far in this domain, have skirted around the fact that they do other things. So so there's a big gap, because partly the existence theory has to, the hypotheses you put into an existence theory are already high, and the effort should bring them low before then we move to higher regularity and such. Or maybe they're coupled, I don't know. But in any case, we are behind the times in that. Yeah?
Isn't it true that there also is a variational approach to this? This is quite different. Presumably, within the variational approach, there are weak solutions which are different.
It might be. Very often, for these problems in Neumann conditions, the variational approach, well, the most of the solutions I know for things like gravity waves, a variational approach just was not a success. It's too weak to actually control things.
But there's a principle that supposedly gives you the same solution to the same problem.
If you have a solution, very possibly, very possibly.
Very
possibly. And that's where the role, that's right, and that's where the role of the weak regularity would go, is that you have a variational problem that gives you something extremely weak, study this object. Is it actually a bona fide object? Have I inspired anyone to look at the Neumann problem now? Well, maybe. Any other questions? Thanks for coming. There's a talk tomorrow